Before the podcast begins, I need your attention. In the next few minutes, I'm going to ask you to support our organization, Torch, in our annual campaign, our annual fundraiser that's happening right now at givetorch.org. You can find the link in the description of the podcast. Now, you may be resistant to my efforts. That's okay. I'm going to do my best to persuade you that this is a good idea, to pause the podcast right now and to click the link and to visit givetorch.org and to support the great work of Torch, our organization, Torch. It's a non-profit organization. We don't charge for our classes, for our facility, for our podcasts. And the only way we can do our sacred work, the only way we can continue our sacred work, it's only if we fundraise. And I'll tell you, I don't know about anyone else, I didn't go to rabbi school to learn how to fundraise. In fact, it wasn't even part of the curriculum, but it's part of the job. Fundraising is not the reason why any of us got into this field. We don't like to fundraise. So a few years ago, my colleagues and I here at the Torch Center, we made a decision to compress all of our annual fundraising into one campaign, one fundraiser that we do 1 week a year, maybe a week and a half, and that's it. And for 1 week, 1.5 weeks, we work really hard trying to get all of our friends and all the listeners, everyone to chip in, to support us. And if we succeed, if everyone makes their annual gift to Torch right now, givetorch.org, then we could take off our fundraising hat and put it in the shelf until next year. And this is happening right now. So today I'm asking you for your friendship, for your support, for your partnership. Visit givetorch.org. The link is in the description. Every donation is doubled. There's a matching campaign, so your money goes even further. Give what you can give and help make this campaign a success. So please right now, pause, and visit givetorch.org and give what you can to support Torch and the Torch podcasts. And I deeply appreciate that. Okay. I'll wait. I'm not going anywhere. Hit pause. Take your time. I got plenty of time. Visit givetorch.org. Okay. If you are back from your pausing, you heeded my call, and you made a donation at givetorch.org, then all you have to do right now is just fast forward a few minutes until the podcast. But if you're not convinced, you're not yet persuaded, let me try a little harder. Let me try to persuade you. Over the course of the past year, with the help of the Almighty, I've released hundreds of podcast episodes. Over the course of my podcasting career, it's more than 1,500 episodes. And every day, every other day, basically, it's a new podcast. And I work effectively all my time on this craft. And I consider it to be a sacred task. I feel like, to a certain extent, I'm serving as somewhat of an ambassador to spread the Almighty's Torah, to teach, to spread Jewish pride, Jewish knowledge, Jewish history, to do this work. And it's not just me. All my colleagues here at the Torch Center, we're similarly laser focused on the mission to connect Jews and Judaism. So we're doing that locally here in Houston, but of course around the world via our digital offerings. And today I want to ask you for your partnership. We cannot do this alone. We need partners. How do you become a partner, you may ask? Anyone who donates and contributes to the Torch fundraiser at givetorch.org, anyone who does that becomes a partner. If you give what you can give, you're elevated. You're no longer a junior, associate. You're a partner. You can make partner. Your parents will be proud of you. And there are some perks that come with partnership. And it's the greatest perk in the world. It's the merit of Torah all over the world. People are studying together and learning together and listening alongside us. I'm here at the Torch Center and I work here day in, day out, week in, week out to prepare exquisite content of Torah, of Jewish life, of Jewish history, and to disseminate it with the help of the Almighty worldwide. But this is not just my own enterprise. This is not just my colleagues here at the Torch Center. We have partners. and those who support us, who give what they can give at givetorch.org, they become partners and they have a major portion of the merit of what we do. Not everyone can do what we do. Some of y'all are employed, gainfully employed. So you hire us, you partner with us, you outsource your responsibility to spread Torah to your friends here at the Torch Center and all the incredible work that we do here. If you give a lot, that's amazing. Every donation is matched. It's all doubled at givetorch.org. If you can give a little, we love and we cherish that as well. As long as you give what you can give, you are a partner. And I'd like to get this on the record. I want to say publicly, on the record. The merits that we have in spreading Torah, in enriching people's spiritual lives, in feeding souls the world over, and the fact that the messages that we share are shared in countless Shabbos tales around the world, and people are sharing it with their friends and their neighbors and their community members. This entire empire of Torah that emanates from the modest Torch Center in Houston, I hereby declare that those merits are shared with everyone who contributes. All the partners are included. And the opposite, that's true as well. Those who sadly don't contribute, they're not partners, and they don't get any of the merits. The Torch fundraiser at givetorch.org, and the link is in the description. It's not just an opportunity. There's also the opportunity cost of passing. I want your partnership. I want your friendship. I want your listenership. Of course, we love all the listeners. Anyone who says, I want to put on a Torch podcast, I want to listen and learn together, they're cherished. They're beloved. They're special. But only those who contribute to this campaign, to this fundraiser at givetorch.org, only those people are elevated to partner. Only those people get a portion in our merit. Yes, if you study, if you learn, you will have an incredible merit for your own study. That's nothing to sneeze at. But the merit of all the listeners, the more than a million downloads every year, that merit is only for those who contribute. I think it's a good deal. I told my class on Sunday that the Torch Center in Houston, Texas, Torch, it's certainly the best charity in Texas. And it's likely the best, you know, west of the Mississippi. I don't know. In New York, New Jersey, they have some great yeshivas. Maybe those eclipse us. The bang for your buck here is staggering. The amount of people who are touched, the amount of people whose lives are changed as a result of what we do here, it's staggering. The amount of emails that I have, people who were touched, who were moved, it's hard to believe that a small little outfit, a little mom and pop shop here in the Torch Center, what we're able to do, it's just a gift from Hashem, and it's in the merit of maybe our illustrious antecedents, but it's also in the merit of our incredible partners. And if you're listening and you haven't been persuaded, you're like, okay, skip, finally get to the content. When will this pitch end? I'm done with this appeal. I get it. I know what you want. I'm not interested. I'm still urging you. I'm asking you. I'm not pleading. I'm beseeching. No, I'm not beseeching. I'm asking. I'm requesting you to hit pause, visit the fundraiser, givetorch.org. The link is in the description, and give what you can give. If you do that, you're joining a very special fraternity. You're coming to the other side of the table. You're a team member now. If we succeed in reaching our goal, I hereby pledge with the help of the Almighty to continue doing this very important sacrosanct work. I was assured by my friend David that in the event, God forbid, that we're unable to reach our goal and we have to, God forbid, shudder, he did promise me that he'll give me a job as a paralegal in his law firm. What do you think? I think that if I had to hang up the microphone, I probably would be better suited for that sort of work. I don't know, manual labor, a mechanic, a carpenter. Everyone has to know their limitations. But a paralegal, well, I could probably pull that off, I imagine. Maybe the skills that I picked up in yeshiva, debating Talmud, that would help, I think, in the law profession. What do you think? Is that a good option? I really hope it won't come to that. I really hope that you take some time. You hit pause on the podcast and you come give us some love at givetorch.org. You seize this amazing opportunity. You give me a boost. You partner with us. You plant a big, juicy smile on my face. What I need from you is to give what you can give at givetorch.org. I know it's hard. I know it's a hassle. I know I took up a lot of your time trying to persuade you, but it's worth it. Over the course of my 12 years here at Torch, with the help of the Almighty, I've met many people who contributed financially to Torch. I haven't met a single one who regretted giving. It's always hard to give initially, but once you give, there's no regret. So push yourself. Visit givetorch.org. Give what you could give. You won't regret it. And I want to thank you for another amazing year of Torch podcasts. I'm eternally grateful to you for your support, for your listenership, for your friendship, and please, God, for your partnership at givetorch.org. The link is in the description. And until next podcast that has this pitch or next year, thank you so much for supporting our work. My email address is rabbiwolbe@gmail.com. We are up to mitzvah number 145. And today, please God, we will do 145, 146, and 167. And these, as was true with the previous mitzvahs, with the mitzvahs that we are covering now, this relates to sacrifices. Again, we are following the mitzvos and studying them in the order in which they appear in the Torah. So now we're in chapter 7 of Leviticus of Vayikra. And the subject matter is sacrifices. And in particular, we have the laws regarding impurity as it relates to sacrifices. As we shall see, the subject of impurity is very vast. And there are a bunch of mitzvahs that are upcoming that relate to purity and impurity. And the first one we're going to tackle is what happens if there's a sacrifice that becomes impure. Such a sacrifice may not be consumed. And that's mitzvah number 145. Moreover, such a sacrifice may not be offered upon the altar. Instead, it must be discarded. It must be burned. And that is mitzvah number 146. So we have the restriction, the prohibition, the transgression. Do not consume a sacrifice that has become impure. Instead, mitzvah number 146, burn it not upon the altar as a sacrifice, but elsewhere. And finally, we have mitzvah number 167. And that tells us that in the event that the sacrifice is pure, it has not become impure, but the person has. So mitzvah number 145 is when the sacrifice became impure, it cannot be consumed. Mitzvah number 167 is when the person became impure. Such a person may not eat sacrifices. Only someone who is in a ritual state of purity, only such a person may eat sacrifices. So there are two instances when the consumption of sacrifices that would otherwise be permissible to be consumed may not be permissible. And they are, if a person becomes impure, he may not eat sacrifices. If the sacrifices become impure, they may not be consumed. And that's the two mitzvos that we're going to cover today. Now, there is an important difference between these two. When the person is impure, so the sacrifice doesn't matter if it's pure or impure, but if the person is impure, he may not consume the sacrifice. And if he does, it carries the penalty of kares, which is a very serious, harsh penalty of disenfranchisement, of being removed from the nation's a very serious transgression. Whereas when the person is pure and the animal, the sacrifice has become impure, then it is prohibited, but not quite with the same degree. It's just a regular prohibition. Okay, so these are the mitzvahs that we're going to cover today, beginning with mitzvah number 145. When a sacrifice has become impure, it may not be consumed. Now, although the verse that conveys this mitzvah, it addresses the flesh of an animal. So the meat of an animal that became impure, this would apply not only to the flesh, but anything that can be consumed. So the meal offerings, the wine, the flour, and even the things that are not necessarily edible, as we shall see, they may not be consumed once they have become impure. Now the Sefer Chinuch, as he has done numerous times, when he tries to explain the rationale, or at least a rationale that makes sense to us, for mitzvot that relate to sacrifices and the temple, he revisits the general theme of sacrifices and shows how each particular mitzvah fits into the general theme, and thus the reason, the rationale for every particular mitzvah relates back to the overarching goal of sacrifices. The overarching goal of sacrifices is to take something physical and bring it to the temple where the presence of God is present, where God dwells, and to offer the sacrifice, and to have that be a stepping stone for a person to have a transformation in their life, and for the person to rejigger their priorities and realign their goals and their values in life in a way that will be more productive, in a way that will better suit their soul, and to depart from an erroneous path, and to embark upon a new life. The goal of the temple and the sacrifices, well, it's for us to have a transformation. And as we mentioned in the past, the animal sacrifice, that's really symbolic of what we're supposed to do within ourselves. We also have an animal half. We also have physicality. We also have a part of ourselves that ends with death. And the big mistake that we make is to misappropriate our values and our life and our goals and our pursuits to try to optimize the part of us that dies and that remains behind. And when we take a sacrifice, we take an animal and we sacrifice it and we slaughter it and we catch its blood and we walk around with it and we sprinkle it. And then we take the leftover flesh and put it on a fire and send it up to heaven. That's a very powerful and palpable way to get a person to start thinking about what they're doing with their animal selves. Are they dedicating it to God? Or not? So this can be a very transformative experience for a person. And of course, as outsiders to this whole subject, it seems foreign to us. But the general principle, if we could just imagine what this would be like, it would be ground-shaking. It would be life-altering to actually go to the temple, to the Holy Temple, built by Solomon, built by the men of the Great Assembly, and to follow all the protocol to be eligible to be there, and to make sure the animal's appropriate, and to give it over to the Kohen, and to say the appropriate blessings and prayers and confessions. And to actually witness this, that will be life-changing. But in order for it to be life-changing, there are requirements. There are protocols that must be met. And if something is impure, something's off, if there is an infiltration of impurity, it's not really going to have the same impact. And therefore, if the person's impure or if the animal's impure, that will detract from the awesome power, the awesome effect that a sacrifice is designed to have. And therefore, in the event that the sacrifice went awry, it became impure, the person became impure, okay, this is not the kind of sacrifice, the kind of environment that is suitable to have the impact that sacrifices are designed to have. And therefore, the person is impure, the animal is impure, they cannot be consumed. We do not follow the typical process of a sacrifice, and instead the animal must be burned. Now, there are myriads of laws in each one of these mitzvot, and we're just trying to get a little snapshot, a little flavor, if you will, of all these mitzvot. And the Sefer Chinuch, which is the book that is guiding us in this goal, in this pursuit, he offers a little sampling of some of the laws that relate to each one of these mitzvos. And he tells us, which I found to be interesting, that not only is it prohibited to consume from an animal that became impure, you cannot deliberately cause impurity, meaning if a person is impure and they see a sacrifice, there will be a prohibition to convey that impurity towards that sacrifice. And this opens up for us a very, very large subject. And that's namely the idea of impurity, how something becomes impure, and the conveyance of impurity. There are all sorts of ways that things can become impure. There are all sorts of bastions, if you will, of impurity. And we'll talk more about this as we go through these mitzvos. But someone who is impure, as an example, the most impure thing in the laws of impurity is a dead human body. That's known as Avi Avos Hatumah, the granddaddy, if you will, of impurity. If someone touches or carries or is in the same room as a dead body, they are impure, so they would not be allowed to eat sacrifices. And if they touch a sacrifice, they will render it impure. And we know this is where the red heifer comes in. The only way to undo that, to reverse that, to cleanse that, to render the person pure, is via the red heifer process. Which is why it's so important. Which is why, just to make this practical for us, Jews are not allowed to go on to Temple Mount because a mitzvah that we have not yet studied, but a mitzvah that is in the Torah, tells us that we cannot tread upon the grounds of the temple if we are impure. Every single person today is considered that they are impure from the impurity of a dead body. If you are in a hospital, okay, it's a very large room, really, because it's all connected. And there's a dead body in the hospital, well, congratulations, you are impure now. And again, it's important to differentiate between, like, impurity being something hygienic or something which is dirty. It's not that. There is laws of impurity, and it's very hard for us to understand them, and I'll try to make maybe an association that we can use to make it a little bit more understandable to us. But we have an assumption. We presume every person today is impure from the impurity of a dead body. If you're by a funeral, you're now impure. And unless you've undergone the process of a red heifer, there's no way for you to undo that. And therefore, walking upon Temple Mount is a violation of this prohibition against someone who is impure going upon temple grounds. But the whole subject is very distant, and I will tell you that there are enormous portions of Torah that relate to the laws of purity and impurity. And again, for us, it's hard for us to understand because it's not dirty. It's not anything which is perceptible to us. I had a pet theory during the pandemic. One of the takeaways from the pandemic is this general idea that there are invisible things that can impact a person and can cause great harm, but it's not perceptible by humans. It's below the threshold that we can perceive it, and it can be conveyed. You got to be far away from such a person, because what if they cough and all the viral load? You remember the viral load? The viral load gets spread, and keep your 6 feet away and wear your mask. Let's not go there. Let's not go there. But the concept that there is something which is invisible, but it's real, and it can have enormous cataclysmic effects, that's a good analogy for purity and impurity. And again, you look at the Talmud, you look at the Mishnah, 63 books of Mishnah, a sixth of that relates to Taras, which is the laws of Tara, of purity and impurity. And there's all sorts of different types of impurity, different levels of impurity, different means of conveying impurity. It's very complex and intricate, but for our purposes, if a sacrifice becomes impure, it may not be eaten. If a person becomes impure, that person cannot eat a sacrifice, and such a sacrifice must be burned. Now, the Sefer Chinuch adds an interesting law that we briefly mentioned earlier. Even inedible parts of a sacrifice. So we talked about the meal offering. Meal offering, it's flour, it's oil, and it's lavona, it's frankincense. Those are not considered to be edible. They're herbs and spices that are not edible. But suppose that became impure. And a person, even though it's not edible, they decide to eat it. Like one of those, you know, YouTube challenges they used to have. You know, can you eat this really hot spicy pepper? Can you eat this fistful of cinnamon? But why is Gen Z so dumb? Okay, because you watch all that nonsense. And it affects you. It used to be the millennials. Now the millennials are spared. It used to be the boomers. I hate to say it. It used to be the boomers. And then Gen X. And then millennials. And now it's Gen Z. If you have something which is inedible, it becomes impure. It's part of a sacrifice. Someone who consumes that is violating this prohibition. And, you know, to us that sounds self-understood. Well, okay, it's part of a sacrifice. It became impure. And, of course, it would fall under this category. But if we develop a little bit more of a knowledge base in laws of purity and impurity, we know that something which is inedible typically cannot become susceptible to impurity. And the reason for this is because purity and impurity really affect only people, utensils, and edible food. And if something which is inedible, well, then it would typically not be a receptacle of impurity, yet with regards to sacrifices, because it is a sacrifice, that would be an exception to this rule, and it would become susceptible to impurity, and thus it would be included in this prohibition to not consume from a sacrifice or any part of a sacrifice that became impure. Now, mitzvah number 146 tells us that it must be burned. And the Sefer Chinuch tells us that there's a very good reason why it must be burned. We do not want invalid sacrifices hanging around. We don't want anyone to say, oh, look at this sacrifice and look at it rotting and decaying. And therefore, it must be eliminated. And the best way to eliminate it, the best way to dispose of it, the best way to remove any association with the sacrifice is by burning it. And if the sacrifice became impure inside the temple, then it will be burned into the temple. If it became impure outside the temple, it will be burned outside of the temple. And again, this is also novel, because if a person became impure, suppose there was a person that became impure inside the temple, such a person would be required to immediately exit the temple. If there's a dead body, for example, someone dies, they have a heart attack in the temple. They quickly must be ushered out of the temple, because you cannot have this impurity inside the temple. That said, when it comes to an animal, a sacrifice that became impure, it can stay there and it will be burned, not on the altar, of course, but on a designated spot towards the east of the altar. There's a designated spot where sacrifices that became impure are burned, and that is where it would be disposed of. Now, the Sefer Chinuch, in his commentary to this mitzvah, he has a bunch of asides. And he talks about the bones. The bones, must they be burned? Well, if they have marrow in it, well, then they must be burned. Otherwise, they need not be burned. However, the paschal lamb, that is burned. And the reason why the paschal lamb is different, and I found this to be interesting. I don't know if you'll find this to be interesting, but I did. A paschal lamb has a law that applies to no other sacrifice. And that is the prohibition against breaking a bone. No bone may be broken in the paschal lamb. And therefore, there's going to be meat that will not be accessible. Because the marrow of the animal, it's inside the bone. The only way to access it, I've been told, is by cracking the bones. Well, if you cannot crack the bone, then you cannot remove the marrow. And therefore, you'll have leftover sacrificial meat. And as we know, leftover sacrificial meat, we talked about this in Mitzvah, I think it's 142, must be burned. And therefore, when it comes to all sacrifices that need to be burned, we don't burn the bones because there's no meat there. But when it comes to the paschal lamb, we assume that there will be meat left uneaten and they must be burned. And Sefer Chinuch, he says, okay, we're talking about burning sacrifices. Let's talk about all the things that need to be burned. All the things that halakhically need to be burned. And he goes through a whole list of all these things that the Torah tells us must be burned. First thing is our mitzvah. Sacrificial meat that became impure. And then mitzvah number 142, which is leftover sacrificial meat that was not eaten in time. And then he says a new thing, which is a sacrifice that became impure. Or a mincha, a meal offering that became impure. Or an uncertain sin offering. This is the offering that a person brings if they're not sure if they sinned or not. Did I violate? Did I not violate? And this person discovers that actually they did not violate. And therefore, this sacrifice is now invalid because you only bring the sacrifice because of the uncertainty. Once the uncertainty has been resolved, well, now the sacrifice is invalid and it must be burned. Similarly, the sin offering of a bird sin offering that's brought in a case of a doubt. In such a case, even though typically sin offerings may be consumed, the sin offering of a bird, because it is slaughtered in a different way, well, it may not be consumed. And the hair of a Nazir who finished his Nazir period in purity, that hair is burned. And Arla, which is the first 3 years of a fruit tree. And Kalear Karim, which is a vineyard that was planted adjacent to grain. All those things are burned. And once he's given us lists, he gives us another list of things that are not burned but are buried. And I would recommend, if you want to see the list, it's a nice, interesting, long list, see mitzvah number 146 in the Sefer HaChinuch. And finally, we have mitzvah number 167, and that's the prohibition against a person who became impure from consuming a sacrifice. This tells us that when someone is impure, even if they are in the process of becoming pure, they've gone to the mikvah, let's say, but they haven't finished up to that night, or there's something still left over that they need to do on their to-do list, on their task list for their purification process, they may not eat nor touch any sacrificial food. And he also points us to mitzvah number 367, which I mentioned earlier. That is the prohibition against walking on temple grounds when you are impure. And again, he offers the same rationale. We want to have the prestige of the sacrifices and the temple to be maintained, and therefore only pure animals may be eaten, and only pure people may partake in it in order to amplify and enlarge the prestige and the honor and the stature of sacrifices. Now, because this is our first foray into the laws of purity and impurity, and there is many, many more mitzvos and many more topics to cover in this universe, I want to share with y'all an interesting question about the conveyance of purity and impurity that really covers a lot of the subject of purity and impurity. If you have someone who is impure, there are ways, as we mentioned, for impurity to be conveyed to someone who is pure. So we have two people in the room. One's pure, one's impure. And the impure person touches the pure person. Well, now the person who was previously pure becomes impure. The whole idea of conveyance of purity and impurity is that when the two meet, something pure and something impure, the impure, well, that now gets conveyed. It gets passed over. And the thing that was previously pure is now impure. So here's the question. How come it doesn't happen in reverse? Someone's pure. Someone's impure. And they give each other a high five. Okay, so what happens now? The purity gets conducted in some way from the person who was impure to the person who was previously impure, but now is, I'm sorry, who was previously pure, now is impure. Why doesn't it work in the other way? Let's transmit the purity. Isn't that a novel suggestion? Transmit the purity from the person who was pure to the person who was impure. Why does it go in one direction, not the other? And we know that there's a rule that the Almighty works in a way that is more beneficial for us. God's reward always outweighs his punishment and judgment. So how come when there's this touch point, this meetup of purity and impurity, the impurity overpowers and overrides and conveys the purity, the impurity to the person who was previously pure? I always had this idea during the pandemic. You know, I had this question. I said, wait a minute. So someone that has the illness and they give a sneeze, and before you know it, everyone who's around them now becomes contaminated. It's contagious. The disease is contagious. So my solution is to give one person the vaccine. And just like if one person gets the virus, it can spread to the whole world. Let's do the opposite. One person gets the vaccine and they sneeze and suddenly everyone's vaccinated. And then they sneeze further and everyone gets vaccinated. It's like the opposite of patient zero. You have patient zero, the first patient that somehow contracts the virus. And that could spread to every single corner of the world. Let's do it the opposite way. You only need patient zero, one person to get the vaccine. And let it spread the opposite way. And I spoke to one of my friends who was a doctor. He says, no, Rabbi, you don't understand how this works. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. To become impure, it's easy. To become pure, it's really hard. And that applies with the virus. It applies with laws of purity. They say that, you know, markets, you want to grow up an up market and a bullish market, it's like an escalator. In a bearish market, it's like an elevator. It goes straight down. You want to earn something, it's really, really hard. You know, fitness, you know, you got to do it for months and months and months. And then one binge by the smorgasbord, one binge by the all you can eat, and that's it. You're all the way back where it started. That's the question. Why does it work one way, not the other? So I saw an interesting answer, courtesy of one of the great Hasidic masters. He says, really, it should work both ways. Really, it should work both ways. But here's the problem. If someone is impure, they are impure. And even if they only have a little bit of impurity, well, they have enough impurity to convey further. And they become, the way impurity works is that it takes over. So the person touches the dead body with their finger, right? It's only their finger, right? But how come their toes are impure as well? Well, that's the nature of impurity. That once it takes over, it takes over. If someone wants to be pure, they want to convey that, it really should work. But it has to be like impurity. Just like when a person is impure, they're 100% impure. And therefore, they can convey that further. If someone wants to be pure and convey that purity, they have to be 100% pure. And most of us, maybe all of us, we have some vestiges of impurity. There's some part of us that's not perfectly, pristinely pure. And yes, in an ideal world, it is possible for purity to work like impurity does. For the proverbial vaccine to spread from one person to another. But only 100% purity has that power. If there's a little bit, a little remnant, a scintilla of impurity, that will inhibit, that will preclude the purity from spreading. So this to me is a very novel idea, that it's possible, it's theoretically possible, to have one vaccine that changes the whole world, to have one bastion of purity that changes everything. And I was thinking that maybe this is an element of Messiah. If you have one person, one force that is so completely pure that purity just permeates that person entirely, actually that would work. And someone just being in the same room, in the same hospital, just like it just spreads everywhere. I think maybe this is like, you know, Abraham. Abraham grew up in a world that was completely immersed in idolatry. And he managed to impact tens of thousands of people to become adherents to his very novel and very strange for them way of life. Monotheism, one power? It was a very radical idea at the time. But he managed to get myriads of followers. What was his trick? What were his tactics? So we think that, well, you know, he was very persuasive. He was very intelligent. He was very charismatic. He was very kind. Someone comes to his house and he would give them so much food and he would ply them with food and drink, and that would make them more receptive. And of course, all of that is true. But maybe it was this. He himself was so pure that just interacting with him would have that effect. He would be the patient zero of righteousness. And any person that he encountered, provided that the person was not clinging to impurity, provided the person had some degree of receptiveness, he would impact them. The Talmud gives us a very dramatic story about a Roman who converted, joined the Jewish people, and made a very significant contribution to the Jewish library. And of course, we're talking about Uncleus the convert. And he was a nephew, I think, of the Emperor Nero. And he joined the Jews. And the Talmud tells us that his uncle in Rome was very disappointed about the new conversion, the new religion that his nephew adopted. So he sent a legion of soldiers to go rescue him from this cult. Go save him from these crazy Jews. Especially because at the time the Jews were very hated by the Romans. So he sends a legion, some sort of, not a legion, but a group, a company, a battalion, to go kidnap Uncleus. And they go there and they don't return because they just meet him and he starts speaking to them and he persuades them to convert. So they join the Jewish people as well. So he sends a second group and he tells them, don't chat with him. And Don't listen to him. He's so persuasive. And he manages to convert them as well. He says the third group, don't even hear a word he has to say. And he goes and he kisses the mezuzah. We know the story. The Talmud tells us the book of Avodah Zarah, page 11a. And after three groups were persuaded, they just gave up on him. He's just too powerful. Now, we have a documentation of what Unculus told them. And it always kind of struck me, like, this is it? This is the message that's so persuasive? You know, it's a very nice message. It's about how, you know, God protects us, and, you know, he talks about the difference between the Roman king and the king of all kings. It's a nice message. It's a powerful message. But is it really effective enough to move the needle of a group of hardened Roman soldiers? Seems not. I think this is the answer. He was someone that had become so pure and had eliminated any vestige of impurity, that he had this power, this Abraham, we could call it almost a Messiah-like power, that just meeting him, that would be the impact. And no matter how many Romans you sent, doesn't matter. He'd vaccinate all of them. And that's, to me, was a very novel and interesting idea. You know, it's not a coincidence that the rabbis tasked Unculus with writing the authoritative translation of the Torah. And the Talmud even says that his translation was so accurate that it actually matched the translation that was given at Sinai. He was able to kind of channel the Sinai revelation on his own. How do you do that? Only if you've completely cleansed yourself, removed any little bit of impurity from yourself. Well, if there's no impurity at all, it's just purity. Well, then purity will actually override impurity. And just an encounter, just a meeting of purity and impurity. In that case, when it's 100% purity, the purity will win. So again, we have mitzvos here that are hard for us to have some sort of understanding in. The whole idea of sacrifices just on its own, that is difficult enough for us. Now we have sacrifices matched with purity and impurity. The whole thing is a mystery to us. But some of the concepts I think are valuable. And again, we hope to open up, well, we hope to, of course, see some of these laws that are upcoming about purity and impurity and to get more of a sense of what they really are all about. But as we mentioned in the past, we really hope to be able to witness some of these mitzvos in play, to witness the temple, to witness the sacrifices, to be able to gain some of the transformations that are present in sacrifices, and to be able to be elevated and transformed by the Almighty and His mitzvos. And of course, my email address is rabbiwolbergymer.com. I look forward to your questions, your comments, and your feedback. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Again, the website for the Torch fundraiser, for the annual Torch fundraiser, is happening right now. The website is givetorch.org. Every donation is doubled. Please visit givetorch.org. The link is in the description. Give a click on the link and give what you can give and support the great work of Torch in 2024. Again, the website is givetorch.org.